Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 2 of the Dissident Film Club. My name is Keaton Weiss, back, of course, with Mr. Justin Van Voris.
Faux show.
So, we are going to be talking today about the new Spike Lee movie, which is released on Netflix, called Da Five Bloods. And I watched this yesterday. You, I guess, watched it a few days prior. And so let's talk about that, and we'll probably get into some more of Spike Lee's filmography as we go. But I just watched it yesterday. It's a little fresher in my mind, maybe than yours, although you watched it, what, a few days ago?
Yeah, you watched it yesterday. I watched it the day before.
Oh, okay.
It's not like there are years in between. Let's see, you watched it. I watched it yesterday. You watched it the day before, so you probably don't remember much of it.
Right, exactly.
You probably don't remember much of it, even though there's only about a 12-hour difference in between viewings. No, I remember. It's pretty fresh in my mind. I don't think you have to worry about that.
All right. So what did you think of it? I mean, I'd rather have you go first.
Well, I think that, first of all, it's perfect that we're talking about on this podcast, because you can't think probably of more of a dissident filmmaker than Spike Lee. I mean, Spike Lee has been talking about things that we talk about today in his art and his movies for 30 years now. Spike Lee, you know, for me, what I like about Spike Lee is that he's a true definition of the artist, in the fact that every movie of his has his fingerprints all over them. It's like a movie, usually great films, you can tell, are really a product of the auteur. And any Spike Lee movie you watch, you always can see that, oh, this was clearly a Spike Lee film, a Spike Lee joint. Having said that, throughout his career, I think that he has some masterpieces. I think that at times he can be a little uneven. And I would tend to agree that this movie, despite a lot of the praise that it's getting, is on more of the uneven end of the spectrum. What do you think?
Well, when you say uneven, you're talking about the fact that it's basically, I get what you're saying, and that has been a critique of this movie, that it really is a few different films in one. I mean, it's all kinds of stuff. It's crazy. It's a wild movie. But I enjoyed it. I really liked it. And I feel like that's the only way you could really talk about a movie like this, is whether you liked it or not. Because I could see how, from an objective standpoint, yeah, you could make all kinds of criticisms about how, you know, at first you don't know if it's going to be a period film or set in the present day. You figure, okay, maybe half of this movie is going to take place in flashback, when these five bloods, you know, were in Vietnam. Let me just set up a little bit of what it's about. So the premise of the movie is that four Vietnam veterans, four African-American vets, reunite in Vietnam 50 years after the war, you know, that takes place in present day, and they are going to recover a loot of gold bars that they buried and were supposed to return to back when the war was going on. It was a CIA payoff that got interrupted by, you know, an ambush, by some fire, and they buried the gold, and they were going to go and find that gold before they left. And that never happened. One of the five bloods was killed. Storm and Norman, played by Chadwick Boseman, right?
Yes.
The actor who played that, yep. And so years later, decades later, the four surviving brothers decide they're going to go back and find this gold. And they have different ideas about what they're going to do with it. Some people thought they should redistribute that gold to invest it in the current black experience. They thought of it as a form of reparations at the time, right? Because they were going to be sent to die in Vietnam on the front lines for a country that was still treating them like garbage. And this was even post-signing of the Civil Rights Act, obviously. And so that's the premise of the movie. That these four guys go back and they're going to find this sort of hidden treasure So at the beginning, you don't really know if this is going to be like part just drama between these four guys, and then the meat of the movie is going to take place in flashback during the actual Vietnam War. You don't really know where it's going. And then it literally, with an explosion, it literally explodes into the second half of the movie to become this sort of adventure, heist, caper, shoot 'em up action thriller.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of comedy in the mix too. It's funny. It plays like a black comedy at a lot of points. So it's drama, it's comedy, it's a war film, it's a historical film, it's a chase film, it's a heist film, it's a shoot 'em up, it's everything in one. And so I totally get the criticism that it could have focused on one or two of those things, perhaps. But you know what? If it did, it wouldn't really be a Spike Lee movie. Like, well,
that's
I always,
the thing, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's what gives him his style. I could say so much about him as a filmmaker, and I'm sure we will as time goes on. I don't want to say too much right off the bat because I want to talk about the specifics of the movie first. But I'll just say in general, I always thought of Spike Lee. You know, there's another filmmaker who Spike Lee reminds me of, and this is going to throw the audience, and you're probably going to laugh at me when I say this, and it sounds like a weird thing to say at first, but Spike Lee, from an audience point of view at least, experiencing his movies, he is in the realm of like an M. Night Shyamalan to me, which is that he's obviously has tremendous talent. He's an original storyteller. Some of what he does really works. Some of it really doesn't work. But even when he fails, he's interesting. And I think Shyamalan is in that same vein. Like, he's made some terrible movies, but I've never really been bored at one of his movies because he's so original. He's so his own filmmaker. And Spike Lee is the same way. And I don't think this movie's a failure at all. I actually liked it quite a bit. But I'm saying, like, it makes it hard to objectively analyze his movies because, like you said, his fingerprints are all over it. The flaws are what give it its edge. It is what makes it unique. Right.
Yeah.
Even his trademarks, like the dolly shot, which happens at the end. In every Spike Lee movie, a character stands on a dolly and it creates this like surreal effect where he's walking, but his feet aren't moving. You can see he's on a moving platform. Even that, as much as like, yeah, it's this cool signature style, but it's almost like film school. Like, I feel like Spike Lee never really left film school. He's always been trying to figure out how to make a movie. Right. He's always been a guy with a camera, just inserting himself into the stories he tells and documenting them in such a subjective way, in such an unmistakable way. Like, even, all right, I'll do one more example, and then I'll throw back to you because I know I went longer here than I thought I would. There's a great monologue that the Delroy Lindo character does towards the end of the movie where he breaks the fourth wall. He stares right into the camera, just like Spike Lee himself did in She's Gotta Have It.
Is this the one in the jungle or when he's
in the jungle,
the
right before, okay. You know, right when he splits from the group. And he does this monologue into the camera, breaks the fourth wall, which is another thing that Spike has done from time to time. I remember his debut film had a lot of that in it, as I just mentioned. And then at the very end of the monologue, the camera moves from his face in kind of a clumsy handheld way and just focuses in on his fists in the air, right? He does the Black Power fist in the air and it lingers there for a second. It's not a smooth move. It's not a polished move. It's like I could see a guy at film school saying, I'm going to throw this monologue and then we're just going to move the camera to show what we want to show, his fist in the air. Not a cut, not, you know, it everything has a sort of homemade quality to it.
Yeah.
And that's, to me, the charm. That's what makes him an artist who has really stood the test of time for now, you know, almost 35 years. I think She's Gotta Have It came out in 86.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, so, I mean, I totally agree. I totally agree with that. Spike Lee tends to have probably all control. At this point in his life, he probably has final cut everything he does. And so all these movies that he makes seemingly are like these ideas of like, why don't I just do this? Why don't I just do that? The thing is that like some, I think, are more successful than others. And so you could appreciate that. You could appreciate that his movies are very authentic that way because, I've felt that, like, some moments in his movies are, like, really, really great, really, really beautiful, and then others have this more amateurish film school kind of quality to them. And you could appreciate that, the guy that just goes ahead and just does whatever you want. On the whole, though, it kind of just, and this is all maybe personal taste. It just for me, it kind of creates just a messier movie. Like you mentioned, like a lot of different things this movie is, and while that is like entertaining for a lot of people, and like I said, it's an entertaining film. I enjoyed it, for others, it may come off as a little messy, and that's kind of what it did for me. But that's personal taste. I respect the artist so much that he's able to do this and just do whatever he wants. In that way, honestly, he reminds me a lot of like Kevin Smith, because Kevin Smith, he does basically whatever he wants. Unfortunately, he has like more bad ideas than good ideas. He's kind of like the opposite of Spike Lee, but they essentially just both do the exact same thing. His movies, though, just a little backstory on this movie, which I found very interesting. So this movie was a spec script that I guess was floating around Hollywood that was called The Last Tour. And apparently Oliver Stone was going to direct it at one point. It was actually written by Paul DeMeo and Danny Bilson, who wrote one of my favorite movies of all time, ironically enough, The Rocketeer. And it was like Black Klansman. It was rewritten. It was an original screenplay that was rewritten by him, Spike Lee, and Kevin Willmott. And that's when they added the African-American factor to it. I like that. I like that. I think there should be more war movies from the African American perspective. Just because it's every time you do one of these things, it's very ironic because anytime you put African Americans in a war movie setting, it's kind of hypocritical because at each point that these movies are taking place, African Americans are treated poorly, yet they're being forced to defend their country that treats them so poorly. And we've never really gotten a African-American experience look at the Vietnam War. And the Vietnam War, when that was raging on, there was so much raging on in this country at the same time. And so I thought that was a great way to set it. And I like that aspect of it. I like the treasure hunt aspect of it, because at some point, I think we'll get into spoilers in a bit. They essentially, once they find the gold, they kind of have to escape kind of an area that has like landmines in it, and the movie kind of just becomes, because then they deal with Vietnamese forces that are in there, and so for these old guys, these old timers, they essentially have to fight the Vietnam War again in present day, which I thought was very, very clever. I thought everything was clever about the story, and I just think that what Spike does, I'm going to refer to this a lot, he spikes it up a lot. And I thought that's where...
He would like that phrase.
Yeah, he spikes it up a lot.
He would approve of that. He would get a kick out of that.
And that's where it came in. Some of his flourishes I liked, and some of them, you know, I didn't like. And we've talked about how, like, each Spike Lee movie is almost like an amalgam of all his other movies. Like, he wants to put, like, a lot of stuff in his movies that he's touched upon in a lot of his movies. Like there's interracial relationship that goes back to Jungle Fever.
Mm-hmm. Yep, good point.
There's another war movie that he made, a World War II movie called Miracle at St. Anna, which I did not like. There's a character in that who is like the Hanoi Jane, Miss Hanoi on the radio character.
Yeah,
there's a character like that in that movie.
Well, even Hanoi Hannah, I mean, that's, you know, that's from Do the Right Thing. There was a radio host sort of doing these interludes at certain points.
Absolutely.
Throughout the movie. You could call that almost not a trademark, but a recurring sort of device.
Right, yeah. In like Black Klansman, he does a lot on Birth of a Nation, that film, and so he put that into that movie, which I have a problem with. It's just something that I've noticed over many years. He likes to make his movies like amalgam of every movie that he's ever made, which I think is very interesting. For this movie, I think it was too much of everything.
So, first of all, when it comes to spoilers, just as a general rule on this show, we're going to try to minimize the spoilers. If there are any spoilers, we'll certainly warn people, and we'll try to put the spoiler segment of the show toward the very end so that you could at least listen to 90% of the show before we do that. Anyway, with regards to the setting, yeah, I loved it. There's something thematically very clever Not only do they have to sort of refight the Vietnam War because they have to get past these people who I can't say too much without spoiling it now, but basically they're found out as having, you know, chasing after this gold and some other people want it. That's all I'll basically say about it for now. And yeah, they have to refight the Vietnam War in this, you know, 50 years now post-war Vietnam. But there's something very clever about that, especially when you tell this story from the black perspective, because it, especially because it's being released right now, where we're seeing obviously all these things happen, you know, with regards to the George Floyd protests. There's a great metaphor in there that these guys are now struggling through post-war Vietnam, 50 years since the war ended, but they still have to struggle and gut their way through this new landscape. And that's kind of a metaphor for the black experience here. Like, I bet a lot of black people feel that way about this country. That, yeah, we had the Civil Rights Act signed, you know, 55 years ago, right? We had the Civil Rights Movement 55 years ago, which sort of bled into the anti-war movement. I mean, the anti-Vietnam movement was very much, in many ways, an extension of the Civil Rights Movement. Martin Luther King himself went from pushing for the Civil Rights Act right into anti-poverty stuff, anti-military complex stuff. And I'm sure there are a lot of black people who still feel like this country is like post-war Vietnam is to a Vietnam veteran. Like, yeah, the war is technically over, right? Because we technically have equality under the law. But not really, right? Yeah. We're still kind of walking around this haunted place that has literal landmines still in this place from a bygone era now that can explode and kill you at a moment's notice. I mean, that's really is kind of a metaphor. I mean, look at George Floyd. You could say George Floyd walked into a landmine that day, right? He happened to be coming out of a store. 8 minutes later, he's dead, right? Just like, you know, landmines become a factor in the second half of this movie. So I think that's a really clever thing. The other really clever device that they put in this movie was the MAGA hat. And yeah, the premise that one of these four soldiers, who is Paul, played by
Delroy Lindo,
who is absolutely excellent in the movie.
Yeah.
If there is an Oscars this year, he's gotta be at least a nominee. I would say that's an Oscar-winning performance there. Absolutely.
Yeah, I've been praying. You know, I pray for a lot of things. You know, world peace. You know, cure for cancer.
And the Delroy
That Delroy Lindo would get a decent role in a movie one of these days. I've loved Delroy Lindo for many years. I recently watched Get Shorty a couple months back, and he's great in that movie. I just love his name, and so. This, I think this was a role that was clearly intended for Samuel L. Jackson, but he was absolutely fantastic in this movie, and so I hope he gets some sort of recognition for it.
So they make his character a Trump voter, and they mention at the very beginning of the movie, he mentions that he voted for Donald Trump, and, you know, there's a lot of stilted dialogue surrounding that at the beginning. I think if characters are going to actually talk politics in movies, it's a very difficult thing to pull off, because it always comes off as sort of forced and on the nose, right? Mm-hmm. But anyway, that aside, when they go into the jungle, right, and you know, the SUV pulls up and lets them off and say, okay, you know, good luck, go, you know, do whatever you're gonna do. I don't even know if they told the escort that they were looking for gold. I forget. But anyway, he says, all right, have at it. He pulls this red hat out of his backpack or whatever. And one of them says, is that a MAGA hat? Yeah, and he's wearing this MAGA hat backwards through basically the entire movie.
Yeah.
And the way that MAGA hat changes hands throughout the film was really clever. Really, really clever. And we'll get to that at the end, because that will get into spoilers. But it was really smart the way they handled that MAGA hat. And just the imagery of it, the fact that they chose Delroy Lindo's character as the character who was going to be the Trump voter, was very, very smart in my opinion. Spike Lee was interviewed about this, and he said they wanted to make one of them a Trump supporter just to add some tension between them, because these guys have such a bond and such love for each other. We have to have some source of conflict, right? And so to have one of them be a Trump voter, he thought that was kind of the most extreme thing that we could do, in his opinion. And but there's one character in these Bloods who is, at least we think for most of the movie, a sort of rich guy. Right? A guy who made it, did well for himself. And you would think the simple-minded view of things would be like, okay, well, he would be the Trump voter, right? Rich guy, he's the one who votes red, you know, whatever. But they don't. They pick Delroy Lindo to make the Trump supporter, which was such a great choice and such an insightful choice, because that character, the Paul character, he even says, toward the start of the film, that he's a broken man. He has tremendous PTSD. He feels very guilty about what happened to their fallen brother in arms. He has a very, very tense relationship with his son, for reasons that he reveals a little bit later in the film. That's kind of a minor. I don't feel like that's any like huge secret that we have to guard. But there's a family dynamic there that makes it so that he's a very lonely guy, a very broken guy, and the fact that that is the Trump voter, I think, is such a great metaphor for what has happened in this country, what happened with Brexit. There's a great essay about Brexit called The Politics of Despair. Because he's lost so much hope in himself, in humanity, in the country, in the institutions of the country, in the institution of the family itself, that those are a lot of the kinds of people who voted to leave the EU. And those are a lot of the kinds of people in the Midwest who voted for Trump, people who felt that their lives have already been ruined. Right. And so there's this sort of, and it's obviously kind of a self-destructive thing, right? Where they just double down on, we got to take what's ours, keep it away from the immigrants, build the wall. Right. There's a definite correlation between people who feel broken and lost and people who feel like everything's been taken from them, and people who supported Trump. So I thought that was a really clever choice.
I like that, but just, you know, you bring up the tension. I just didn't feel that that addition actually brought much tension to the movie. There's like one line about it in the restaurant where he's like, I just want to get what's mine. It was just, we've got to build that wall. And then he wears the hat through the movie, but there's really no difference of ideologies that kind of come into play throughout the rest of that movie in regards to him being a Trump supporter. I just seemed wedged in there, and I liked the kind of the visual metaphor of the hat later on in the movie, but I didn't feel it added much tension with him and the rest of the group.
Well, not on a textual level, because there's not much talking about it beyond the first scene, and then there's that little quick reference to it. But I definitely think it adds an element to his character. The fact that the harshest guy there, the most weathered, right? The most sort of brutal, the most visceral, the most violent, the most severe, and the most damaged, and the most wounded, right? And the most vulnerable in a lot of ways. I thought it was a good choice, because the other guys in that troop kind of seem like they more or less pulled their lives together after the war, whereas Paul's character was the only one who really didn't.
But the thing about it is that like the movie is about they become essentially radicalized under the, I forget if he was their captain, but when they are in the war with Chadwick Boseman's character, who kind of radicalized them, he's their Malcolm, he's their Martin, and there's a scene when and there's a scene where they're like, oh yeah, you know, man, we gotta kill crackers, you know, we gotta what's going on at home isn't right. He kind of changes their perspective on it, and I just, you know, maybe there are out there. I just didn't feel that like someone in that group would vote for end up voting for Trump, because it seems to be the opposite of kind of like who I thought these guys were.
Well, that is, but that's the whole thing. I mean, I think that's one of the big points, right, is that Trump got a lot of support from people who you would not necessarily think of as Trump voters, right? People who had this sense of anger and this sense of grievance about them. And when you don't have a Democratic Party that gives a fuck about them at all, then they're going to go for the guy who says, I'm going to bring your job back, you know what I mean, and keep the immigrants out. Like, that's how that works. That's just human psychology, really. It doesn't really have much to do with, you know, what they learned about politics or being radicalized or anything like that. I think that's a, you know, kind of a naturally occurring psychological phenomenon. And I think it is sort of universal. And so, yeah, so I mean, I bought it. I totally bought it. I thought it made sense to me.
What did you think, though, the rest of the crew?
What do you mean?
In terms, I had a couple problems with the crew itself. I like Delroy Lindo. The original cast of this movie was going to be Samuel L. Jackson, Don Cheadle, Giancarlo Esposito, and this crew, I just didn't think were like the strongest bunch of actors. And I also didn't believe that these guys had been in a war. I don't know how much training they went through beforehand, but one of the guy that is the supposedly rich guy, I didn't think that he was very good at all. I think that he was also too young for the role. But one of the things that I think would have made this movie better is if there was a stronger core group in terms of performances besides Delroy Lindo.
Yeah, I think Clark Peters is quite good. He played Otis.
Yeah, and you know, he's good. And what's interesting about Clark, we'll continue, then I'll get back to that.
No, that's okay. I mean, I think that's a fair point, that there really wasn't a lot of development, not that much character development for anybody but the Lindo character and his son. And obviously Otis, we know, had the love child with the Vietnamese prostitute. Once again, that's just added in there. You know what I mean? Like, it's a, like the movie did not need that whatsoever, right? It's just another thing to throw in. And there was no real arc to that story either, really.
Ultimately.
And so it was a little strange. So I would take that point. I mean, I think that's a fair point, that there really wasn't much else. But that, once again, I think that adds to the strength of the Lindo character, because you got the sense that, like I said, everybody else in that crew had sort of moved on reasonably well. Obviously, you know, they had some issues of their own. They say, you know, we all have PTSD, right? That, you know, when he has that PTSD episode on the boat where the guy is trying to sell him, you know, a chicken and trying to sell him, you know, fruit, and he freaks out. You know, everybody tries to say, you know, that they have a hard time too, but they obviously, it wasn't the same as it was for him. But no, I mean, yeah. I think overall that's a fair point.
I don't want to get into spoilers yet, but I'll go back to what I was going to say about Clark Peters. Clark Peters, what I found interesting is that I didn't know who he was. I looked him up, and he actually was because I was trying to figure out like how old these guys were, because that one guy didn't seem that he was old enough to have been in Vietnam, and it turns out he wasn't. He would have been like 7 during the Vietnam War. But I looked up Clark Peters, and Clark Peters, just to see if he was in any other Spike Lee movies, and Clark Peters actually was a very famous, but he was a notable draft dodger during the war. And so I thought that was an interesting thing to cast him, because apparently he had said at one point, you know, the crux of Vietnam is like why were we over there. You know, if you got an enemy coming to America, yeah, I'll go on the front lines, but I'm not going to go over to Vietnam to fight over there for no reason. That's why when it comes to Vietnam, I kind of have a soft spot for draft dodgers in that regard. But I thought casting someone like him was very, very interesting. Having said that, to have known that this movie could have been with Samuel L. Jackson and Giancarlo Esposito and Don Cheadle, I think that could have been a stronger core group, because they're such a fantastic bunch of actors. And what this movie does, which I thought was interesting, it works to its advantage and also works to its disadvantage, is that while this was, I guess, Spike Lee's most expensive movie he ever made, they didn't have that Irishman budget. So in these flashback scenes, they don't de-age the actors. So when you first watch it, watch these flashback scenes of when they're in Vietnam, it's a little jarring because you have Chadwick Boseman, who's young, and then you have these four other guys who are supposed to be in their 20s, but they look exactly like they're in their 60s or 70s when the present-day scenes take place. And there's scenes when, like, he's talking to them, and it's just kind of, like, weird because they're actually supposed to be playing, like, 20-year-olds. But, you know, I kind of like that effect. Instead of casting younger actors or, you know, de-aging them or just digitally or with actual physical makeup, it kind of is an interesting concept of that these four older guys are looking back on their life, and through their memories, they see themselves as the way that they are now. And so those flashbacks are kind of like the way they see themselves at this point. What did you think of that, how that was done?
I'm glad you mentioned it. I actually liked it. Like I said, it's one of those Spike-isms. You know, he embraces the sort of theatrical nature of movie making, to the point where, you know, he's very keen to remind the audience over and over again throughout his films that this is a movie, right? When you have actors breaking the fourth wall and talking to the audience, right? Or even when you have, like in this case, you know, they call Donald Trump President Fake Bone Spurs, and then they show some, you know, real life footage of Donald Trump, and it says President Fake Bone Spurs on
it. Yeah.
You know, just like those little touches, like he's always reminding the audience that this is my presentation to you. And so it takes on a very theatrical sort of quality in that way. A lot of his movies do, and this did also. And so I kind of thought it was a neat choice to just not fake it, not go crazy with makeup, or not try and sort of de-age, you know, the other four members with any sort of like technological tricks. No, just, you know, these are the characters. Like, that's how, if you were to watch this as a stage play, that's the way they would do it, right?
Right.
and so that kind of, it worked. I didn't mind it. You mentioned Clark Peters. He had the lead role in the movie that Spike Lee financed. Remember, he did like a GoFundMe Kickstarter thing.
Oh, is that The Sweet Blood of the Jesus?
Actually, no, you're right. Actually, a good call. Unless he did it too. No, you're right. That was the one that he self-funded. This is not, to my knowledge, although he may have done it with this too. Maybe he did two movies like this. A movie called Red Hook Summer.
Oh yeah, I don't think he GoFundMe that.
Okay,
I think that's the vampire movie.
Okay,
I didn't see.
That sounds right. No, I didn't see the vampire one either. Red Hook Summer, that's another really bizarre movie. Peters was very good. He was the lead in that role. He plays a pastor at a church in Brooklyn, and let me see here. I'm just reading IMDb because I forget what the exact relationship to the main character was. Okay, so he was the grandfather of this boy in like a, you know, fairly well-off southern family, has to go spend a summer in the housing projects living with his grandfather, who, you know, leads this church group. And it's a nice movie, you know, for the first hour and a half or whatever, it's perfectly nice. And then there's this completely out-of-nowhere twist. No hints, no lead ups, there are no clues throughout the movie. All of a sudden, about 20 minutes before the movie ends, we find out that the grandfather was a child molester. This kid comes to the church and says, "You raped me when I was a boy." It completely changes the whole tone of the movie. It was completely out of left field. Didn't really work.
Yeah.
But yeah, he was good in that too.
I didn't see that. I had heard mixed things about that one. That's the one that's kind of a pseudo sequel to Do the Right Thing, because doesn't Spike Lee appear in that movie as his Do the Right Thing character?
Yeah, you know, I think you're right. Man, that came out in 2012, and I saw it when it came out, so it's been a while. But yeah, I mean, obviously it takes place in Brooklyn, and so yeah, you could think of that. And, you know, most of the movie was perfectly fine. Most of it was, you know, it was kind of a nice family drama. But then to have a twist that crazy and that out of nowhere just come up at the end was just wild. And that's another Spike-ism where, like, he will, like, so many of his characters harbor these, like, secrets that they reveal at a certain point in the movie that obviously they knew the whole time, but we didn't know, right? Yeah,
that happens in this movie.
That happens in this one. Yeah, that happens, actually, I think a couple times. But, I mean, the big reveal, obviously. And this is not a huge plot point, so this is, like I said, a minor spoiler, so you can turn the volume down for 30 seconds.
I think we should get into spoilers now. I think we've placated them enough.
Yeah, so if you really don't want to hear spoilers, you might want to turn it off for a few minutes. If you don't care that much about spoilers, you don't have to. This isn't a movie like The Sixth Sense, where if you learn something about it before going in, it's going to totally ruin the experience. So unless you're really precious about not knowing anything going into a movie, I would invite you to hang around. But if you're one of those people who like really doesn't want to know, then thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
See you next time.
Yeah, I'll have to come up with a musical cue.
Trying to do the drums.
Right, we'll have to come up with a musical segment to go into, like, the spoiler zone.
Spoilers, ba-do-ba-do. So one of the questions that I had is that as the movie goes on, and this kind of leads into the spoiler that I was talking about, is that you find out that Chadwick Boseman, who's one of my favorites, I think
he has a great career
ahead of him.
I forgot about this one. Yeah, you're right.
He was, of course, killed. He doesn't survive Vietnam. And then you find out later that it was because Delroy Lindo accidentally shot him.
Yeah, it was a friendly fire.
Him.
Yeah,
and he's been carrying around with this. And then there's kind of a scene where he makes peace with him in his memory in the jungle there. But the Delroy Lindo character, I wasn't sure if I was supposed to like him or not, because there is a scene where they are kind of caught by this this group that kind of looks for landmines, and so they know that they are taking this gold.
Right, and so let me just set that up for a second. There are these activists there, you know, these white do-gooder French activists who go out, and I guess their goal is to safely detonate these landmines so they don't hurt kids, right? Because the idea is, and this is one of the other things that's haunting about the movie and the whole concept, there are still landmines left over from the war that people can step on and get themselves killed. Or that kid in the beginning of the movie, one of the very first scenes, he comes in with one leg. It doesn't explicitly say that he stepped on a landmine, but it's a perfectly reasonable thing to think, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so anyway, go ahead. I just wanted to set that up just so it's a
little
clearer.
I wasn't sure if there's more to that.
No. I just wanted to say that's what the landmine thing might need a little explanation. Yeah.
Right. And so they kind of run into each other, and there's two things that I'll talk about here. I'll try not to be long. Is that one of the characters steps on these landmines and blows up. And I thought that the movie, and this is where it almost veered into black comedy for me, like you said.
Oh, yeah. I think that was intentional.
That moment I thought was ruined for me, because when he blows up, the leftover carcass is like the fakest sitcom-esque carcass that you've ever seen in a movie that is supposed to be telling like a kind of a serious tale about a real war, Vietnam. And so this character blows up. He's got no legs left. Half of his arms are missing. And, like, he just has these blood, like, just squirting out of his arm. I thought it was just so B-movie level that it took all of the emotion. It just kind of just ripped all the emotion out of that scene. And that was one of the things that, like, oh, you're doing well, but why did you have to do this? I thought it ruined the moment. Like, what is this?
Catapults the movie into the second act. You don't even know where it's really going. You're like, okay, they got the gold. We kind of know some.
No, I love the moment. I love the moment. I just hated the body. Like,
okay,
I'm looking.
You didn't like. I liked the moment. Yeah.
I didn't like how this was portrayed. It cheapened the moment. But that's not what I was getting at. So basically, what happens
that didn't
is that
bother me. For the record, I didn't think it looked that bad.
It bothered me.
Okay. Sorry to hear.
Yeah. So. Basically, what happens is that they get kind of caught with this gold by the activists, and then Delroy Lindo's character.
Well, the activists aren't the ones that end up hunting them down. They end up being stuck with them for a while.
Right, exactly. And so Delroy
basically,
Little
they get tipped off. Let me just, since we're in spoiler, just because this will make it easier for the audience to understand. They get tipped off. Turns out the guy who was going to help them launder this gold, right, through customs for a cut of the money, or he was going to put it in some offshore account, whatever. He ends up tipping off, you know, this sort of like, you know, modern Viet Cong type body. We don't even know who they are. Outlaws, obviously, that they're going to go find this gold. And at the end, they basically try to rip them off. They try and take it from them. Right. So in other words, the guy they got in business with, Jean Reno, you know, the great old French actor, haven't seen him in a while. He ends up obviously double crossing them. And that's how they find out where these guys are. And they come and they try to take the gold from them.
Yeah. And but they run into the activist, and then they kind of turn on the act. He turns on the activist, and then he decides to go off into the jungle, and he says to his son, who they just rescued from standing on one of these landmines, he's like, "You betrayed me." And then he like goes off into the jungle, and there's a reason why there's like a contentious relationship with the. With the between the son and the father, but I thought that was like a really like out of nowhere thing just to come back. Nah, you betrayed me. Well, he goes off. He takes the gold. He goes off into the jungle.
Okay, so the thing that is there is that the son, and this is like I said, another just like melodramatic thing that gets introduced towards the end of the movie, is that Delroy Lindo character, his wife died birthing the son, so he's always kind of resented the son for that. That's basically the dynamic there. The scene that I had to actually go back and rewatch, this is going to sound fucked up, but it's actually really true. My TV is near a window, and that scene at night where, you know, his son tries to free the activist was just so poorly lit, so dark. Yeah. I couldn't see what the hell was going on the first time, and so I had to go back and rewatch it on my laptop later.
Honestly, this is a little filmmaking thing. It looked like that scene was actually shot in the day.
Yeah,
and
then
a filter
artificially
on it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it had that look once I saw it on my laptop. But yeah, so I had to watch it. But that's where he felt, I guess, betrayed by his son. Not that his son even did anything, really. His son was flirting with letting the activist woman go. With untying them. And I think the reason why Paul was sort of skeptical is because he didn't trust them. He didn't trust that they weren't going to rat on him, right, or anything like that. He felt that they were onto them. But I also, you know, think that, you know, he was hurt by the whole rest of the squad. He felt like everybody else kind of was turning on him and that his own son sort of sided with them over him. It was a little forced. Like I said, I didn't think that moment worked that well. I think they could have come up with something stronger that gets him to just sort of go off on his own. But I did think it was powerful that when he decides to break from the group and go off into the jungle, that's when he has that great monologue, right? That's when he gets attacked by the snake. And that's when he has this sort of revelation where he, you know, he talks to the ghost of Storm and Norman, who forgives him. So, you know, it was an accident. And then it was a great cut. And again, sort of a darkly comic cut. Goes from this very emotional scene where he's embracing the ghost of his, you know, fallen brother in arms, you know, it's a big emotional thing, and then it cuts right to the Vietnamese guys pointing guns at him because they found him and they want to know where the gold is, and he won't tell them, and they make him dig his own grave and they shoot him. That was a great cut. It skips over the moment where he realizes he's gonna get caught and just cuts right out of that euphoric moment into now he's in big trouble, digging his own grave, right? Getting ready to be killed. And I think
honestly,
you could think it's almost like he knew he was going to die, you know? And I think that's why he goes into that big monologue. And that's why he has the epiphany that he has. Don't forget, he doesn't actually see the ghost, right? It's a ghost in his mind. And I think he finds a way to forgive himself. He finds a way to conjure, because that's really what he's doing. There is no ghost of Norman. The ghost is in his head. So the idea that he goes off on his own, he goes on that great big monologue, and we find out that there's another thing we find out, that he was diagnosed with cancer, that he has lymphoma, right? So that he doesn't have much long, he doesn't have that much longer to live anyway. He's sort of coming to terms with his own death in the jungle of this place that almost killed him 50 years ago. and he conjures up within himself the idea that his friend has forgiven him. And then the next scene, he actually dies. So I thought that sequence worked really well. I didn't think it was justified as well as it could have been. Like I said, I think you're right. I think that scene where he turns on his son again doesn't quite work. But past that point, I think it worked really well. I think it was a great sort of ending for that character. And again, that MAGA hat just gets dirtier and dirtier and grimier and grimier, yeah, and roughed up the whole time. It's such a perfect metaphor for, you know, not only the Trump voter, but it really for what this country is right now.
Yeah, I actually did not expect that all, well, okay, yeah, this is really spoiler territory, but basically Clark Peters ends up being, save for the son of the original soldiers, the only surviving soldier. And which I didn't expect. I really didn't expect everybody to die.
Well, that's the thing. The first half of the movie doesn't even look like that's remotely what the movie's going to be.
Yeah, they seem like, you know, nice. They seem content people. They're not like worried about anything. And you don't know that the movie's going to take that turn. And I just love that whole treasure hunt aspect of the movie. But when Clark Peters looks like he's about to die, he says, what do you say? He says, the five bloods, we don't die, we multiply. And then what happens is that you see that they brought the gold back and they split up the gold amongst these people. And so in a way that through their gold, they did multiply because they were able to bring back that gold and spread that to spread it to all these different people and affect positive change. Because of that gold, whether it's Black Lives Matter, which honestly was not only ironic, but it's also the first time, I think, in a film that they've been prominently featured role. And then give them to the Vietnamese, give them to the French activists for the landmines. And through that, they were able to spread. I like that. I thought that was good.
Yeah, no, I thought that worked. I thought you were going to talk about the death of Isaiah Whitlock's character.
Yeah, Isaiah Whitlock, who's been a Spike Lee, he's been in a lot of Spike Lee movies, and he has that classic line, she, that is, he says in every Spike Lee movie. It's actually, I think, from when he was on The Wire, he said that line. But yeah, at the beginning of the movie, he has some offhand line about, yeah, he would never jump on someone's landmine, and he ends up doing that.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, no, he would never jump on a grenade, right?
Yeah, jump on a grenade, and then he ends up doing
that. Oh, that's interesting. See, I did not catch that, but that makes a lot more sense because there was not a lot of fanfare surrounding the death of such a major character. It was almost funny the way he did it. He says grenade, and he like, why do you have to yell grenade? Is that maybe like a flashback? Is that some PTSD kicking in right there?
Yeah, it was a little callback there.
Yeah, 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 but it was just very. It was just so plainly shot, and just literally just goes out with a thud. He lands on the grenade and explodes. And
speaking of it shot, what did you think of the movie had like four aspect ratios?
Yeah, I thought it was clever that they put the Vietnam War flashbacks in the 4:3 sort of old TV news style.
Yeah.
I thought that worked. Yeah, I thought that I liked that. Like I said, it's kind of a wild, crazy hodgepodge of a movie, but it works. It's entertaining,
that's the thing. You have to appreciate the style of it.
Yeah, and a guy who's after 35 years still just is like, I'm gonna do whatever the hell I want.
But yeah, no. So before we go, what if should we talk about Spike Lee? What are some of your favorite Spike Lee joints?
Well, to me, there's Do the Right Thing and then there's Everything Else. I mean, that's an absolute masterpiece. So that's number one. Do the Right Thing is one of the most essential American movies ever made, I think. I mean, that's in the canon there. Like, you know, I don't know if movies have been around to long enough where you can say there's a great American movie, but like, you know, there's great American plays like, you know, Death of a Salesman, Streetcar, Named Desire, I'd argue Raisin in the Sun is in there. Do the Right Thing is in that canon of just essential American cinema. So nothing he's done to me has even come close to that. But he has done some other great stuff. 25th Hour is a fantastic
That's my
movie.
Favorite.
Great performance by Edward Norton, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Rosario Dawson. And that's it. That's a movie where that breaking of the fourth wall really works. I mean, Edward Norton's monologue there about fuck everybody, fuck this group, fuck that group, yeah. Right? I mean, that's the most memorable part of that film. So that's a really great movie. I think his documentaries have been extraordinary. You know, because he really brings that style, the same style that he brings to his narrative features, he brings to the docs. Four Little Girls, about the Birmingham bombing that killed four young girls. Absolutely extraordinary film. And his two documentaries on New Orleans post-Katrina were excellent as well. He did one is When the Levees Broke, and then the other one was 5 years later. I think it was called God Willing and The Creek Don't Rise. Those yeah. were two four-part documentaries that are absolutely that wonderful. They are fantastic. Have you? Well, the second one, not quite as memorable just because it was 5 years later. Still great. Yeah. But the first one that came out right after the hurricane, did you
yeah,
see that?
Yeah, I did see that. It's a fantastic.
Oh, that was absolutely phenomenal. So yeah. I would say there's Do the Right Thing and then his docs. And then I would say the second best feature to Do the Right Thing is probably, like I said, 25th Hour. Excuse me.
Well, 25th Hour is my personal favorite. I love everything about that movie. I'm a big fan of the Malcolm X film.
Oh, Malcolm X is great, too. Yeah.
And I like the Summer Sam film that he made.
Oh, yeah. Great, too. Yeah. Forgot about that.
And I'm probably forgetting one. But, you know, the thing about this movie and the thing about Spike Lee movies is that he takes a real novelistic approach to his movies, when the fact that, like, in a novel, you can digress. You can, like, have chapters that go in that don't have to do with the main plot, but just go into a little bit more of the character's backstory or why they make decisions. But if you took that out, you really didn't need it. And that's what he does for his movies. Like, there's a film called He Got Game with Denzel Washington. And that movie digresses a lot. There are so many scenes that you might think is extemporaneous that you don't need. But that's just generally what he does in a lot of his movies. And this movie, I felt, was kind of the same thing. But like I said, he's a unique filmmaker, unique vision. And like I said, I think he it's all dependent on you. If you are more appreciative of the art as of what the auteur is doing, or if you are more looking at it from the canvas that you know, it some things shouldn't be that way, and that's kind of where I kind of see things. Where sometimes I do think he gets a little messy, and that generally does bother my experience watching the film. But for others, you may have no problem with that, and maybe I do appreciate the fact that he just does whatever he wants. And so if that's no problem to you, then, you know, you're going to love a Spike Lee joint.
He's able to just make this very sort of kind of intimate style of filmmaking really his own. I mean, they really are like big student films. And I say that in a good way. Like, I don't mean that. Like, he makes amateurism work, right? Yeah. Like, he's not trying to do anything polished. He's just pointing a camera at things and documenting them in a way that a guy who is super excited to just pick up a camera would do. Like, he doesn't. And he seems to be the same guy, and he really is like a young soul. Like, if you watch interviews with him now, he's the same exact guy as when you watch interviews with him, you know, 30 years ago. You know, he has this sort of eternal energy of youth about him.
Absolutely.
Whereas, like, you could really sense that, like, every time this guy picks up a camera, he's just so excited to just go out and do something with it. That's the quality that
he's always angry. And he's continually angry, which always helps with the films. And even though you may, like I said, I may have criticisms of these movies, watching a movie like The Five Bloods or any of these other movies that he's made, they're always more interesting to watch, even if you may not like something or don't think some things are as successful as other things. They're always more interesting to watch and appreciate than, say, once again, a Ron Howard film, which is exactly, everything goes the way you think it's going to go, and it generally does. And so, you know, you watch a Spike Lee joint, not everything's going to be perfect. Some ideas might work better than others, but at least it's always going to be very interesting to watch.
Well, that's why I compared him to M. Night Shyamalan. It's like,
I think Spike is a much better film. But I think he is better. Shyamalan. And Amis, I've been, yeah. I mean, Lady in the Water, that's just a boring movie. That's,
I don't think it's boring. I think it, like I said, anyway, I'm not going to, we don't have to argue about that. But the point is, the reason I bring him up is because I would rather watch M. Night Shyamalan fail than like 90% of other filmmakers succeed. And the same goes for Spike Lee. I'd rather watch him fail than watch 90% of these other guys make what I guess is a good movie. Like, I'd watch a bad Spike Lee movie any day over, like, I don't know, Seabiscuit.
All right.
What, did I offend you? Do you like Seabiscuit?
I think it's a fine film. Not going to get a lot of Seabiscuit lovers watching this podcast. Yeah.
I may have lied when I said this podcast is available everywhere right now. We're obviously going to be releasing these over the weekend from the 19th through the 21st. And Anchor is our host, so we thank Anchor for hosting us for free.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks. And we're on Spotify and Pocket Cast right now, in addition to Anchor, and we should be on the other platform soon if we're not there now. But if we are there now, subscribe on whatever platform you use. We will be on Apple, Google Play fairly soon if we're not there already by the time you guys are hearing this. So thank you guys very much. Check us out on Facebook. We got a Facebook page up for the Film Club. Also, check out all the Due Dissidence podcasts and blogs at DueDissidence.com. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.